I'm going to hold you that to that, Lee. So, well, happy Sabbath, brethren. All right, hold on. Where's Bill? Okay. You know it's coming. You guys, great first effort. We got to let the audience on the cybercast know. I really want them to hear you. So happy Sabbath, brethren. There we go. All right, let's. And as Lee did mention, today is my first split sermon. It reminds me of probably 10 or 11 years ago. I was telling Ron, I was either like 3 months baptized or 6 months baptized, and Mr. Segley came to me and he's like, "Are you ready to speak?" And now, fair enough, I grew up in the church, so it wasn't that crazy, but I was a little surprised. So not as nervous, but just time moves on, and I'm appreciative to Mr. Staley for the growth and opportunity to give a split sermon. So we'll jump in. The title of my message is Biblical Foundation of a Free Western Society. And this will be a continuance or an expansion of my last message. Since I kind of ran through that one, we get to spend some time diving in and not having to rush through all the points. So let me give you the 4 points. So first we'll have, number one is the biblical vision. 2 is this, the development of Western ideas. 3, where is this? Is presidents and jurists that have commented using the Bible, recognizing the foundation that it comes from a biblical history. And then 4, I'm sorry, that was 4. 5 is the Christian, kind of a recap. And then 6 is, kind of our closing application for today. Oh, it's split, okay. Okay, so I want to, like last time, discuss the groundwork that lay beneath our freedoms that we enjoy today and discuss how our moral foundations are based on the biblical values and how we should be proud of that history that we carry that today. And so again, I'll focus on ideas of human dignity, equality before the law, freedom of conscience, and limited government. Not every Western idea has, come directly from the biblical principles, but it's the history there that these ideas, and I'll go through and show these as we work through them. And kind of just to want to capture this is, I think we're pretty familiar with the Declaration of Independence, and it says all men are created equal, endowed by their creator with a certain unalienable rights. And that's really, what I think is great about our founding documents is it acknowledges that rights are not granted by government, that they are endowed by our creator, and government exists not to invent rights, but to protect them. Okay. So first is the biblical vision, dignity, law, and justice. And we see this from the very beginning in Genesis 1, verses 26 and 27. You can turn there. That's Genesis 1, 26 through 27. It says, then God said, let us make man in our image after our likeness. So God created man in his own image. And this is a pretty revolutionary idea that I think gets lost in history. Is we are so used to this Western idea of equality before the law. If you remember early history, kings were God-given, they were divine, and it was the ruling class versus everybody else. And that's not what God says. Yes, there are structures that we want leaders, but everyone is equal before God. And, you know, mostly through human history is that it was based on power, your birth, your tribe, your wealth. But the Bible declares something else, that all before God are equal. Both the king and the peasant, we all share the same creator. The wealthy and the poor, we all bear the same design from God. And this is again repeated here with justice for the vulnerable in Deuteronomy 10 verses 17 through 18. That's Deuteronomy 10, 17 through 18. The Lord your God shows no partiality. He executes justice for the fatherless and the widow. It's our dignity to show love and care for others, not just based on their station. Kind of the golden rule, you know, treat however you want to be treated, or to do something for those that can do nothing for you. So still under number one, secondly, is the rule of law. The Bible also establishes another foundational idea. No ruler is above the law. And so then here in Deuteronomy 17, it's verses 19 and 20. So Deuteronomy 17, 19 and 20. Israel's future king is commanded to write out the law and read it daily. So it says that his heart may not be lifted up above his brothers. And I think that's, as we approach Passover, that we have this vision in the holy days, but we are constantly in our Bibles being reminded of who we are and the pride that we can have, that we are God's image, but also that we can seek to serve those, for those that we can, you know, do, that they can't help us materially anyway, that we just do it because they are also God's children. So again, this harkens back to, going back to being under the law, is, you know, the king is not the source of the law. They are the executor of it. They are still subject to it. And again, here in 2 Samuel 12:7, when Prophet Nathan is talking to King David, he says, Nathan says to David, "You are the man." So even the king is held accountable to justice. He doesn't get to excuse himself because of his power or station. And again, kings were, you know, they were the law. They could make the rules however they wanted. They could exclude themselves from being held accountable. And that's not something I think we consciously think about today, because it's kind of a given that we expect everybody to be held accountable to the law, despite if they are a statesman or somebody of wealth. And then so in here, second, in the development Western institutions, I'll talk about a couple of documents that lead up, and you can kind of hopefully see the progress of this idea moving in as these Christian values help form governments. So number two, the development of Western institutions. The first one under that is going to be the Magna Carta. So in 1215, the English barons had forced King John to sign this declaration, essentially saying what we just discussed, that the king is not exempt from the law. So one line is here. It says, "To no one will we sell, to no one deny or delay a right or justice." And this is essentially about habeas corpus, that it limited the royal authority and affirmed that the king himself must obey the law. And someone will discuss in a little bit, but William Blackstone, it's a name I understand well in the legal field, but he was a legal scholar. But Blackstone explains that the king, so in this idea of habeas corpus, it says, "The king is at all times entitled to have an account why the liberty of any of his subjects is restrained, wherever that restraint may be inflicted." So to me, that says, if you're going to impose upon something us as your subjects, we should be able to impose that back on you, king. And again, this continues this idea of justice and no one being above the law, or no special rights for monarchy comes from what we see in Daniel and Samuel. And in, again, in the opening lines of our declaration that acknowledges that our rights are from our Creator God, not from the kings. Starting with our own early history before we get to the declaration is the Mayflower Compact. It's a covenant in self-government. The pilgrims in 1620, they drafted the Mayflower Compact, and its opening lines says, "Having undertaken for the glory of God and advancement of the Christian faith, we covenant and combine ourselves together into a civil body politic." So notice the structure here. It's an acknowledgement of God first, a covenant among the people. They're binding themselves to be accountable to each other, and a government formed for an order society. If you've known me well or you've listened to my messages, I've, you know, kind of tilt at windmills when I talk about the government. But this is why my message has been so focused on this, is you guys are essentially listening to me square the circle, so to speak, is that we as Christians, we live in an ordered society, and maybe my expectation isn't what it should be or what we know Christ will bring to us. You know, if I have to balance my budget, why can't the government do it? I wish our government leaders would acknowledge God as our founding fathers did, as we do weekly and daily. So while I shouldn't be surprised when our government officials fall short of that perfect standard, it has helped me reconcile that we do come from a lineage of a Christian society, and I believe there's something of a revival going on, so that gives me hope. But I also know that, let me see here. The mercy and grace that God gives to me, I should approach to them to, yes, I may want to rail and rant, but that perfect society I'm looking for is God's kingdom that's coming to us. So secondly is the Declaration of Independence. Probably much more common and well-known is, so the Declaration states, and it's actually not the opening paragraph, it's the second paragraph. There's a little quiz bit for you. It says, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." And again, it acknowledges God. It's God that gives us our rights. It gives us divine providence and guiding history that if we do our best to follow, we can grow and multiply. And that's one of the beautiful things about this nation, is we have gone from sea to sea and coast to coast in a manifest destiny. And then the ending paragraph, again, kind of reaffirms after they essentially list all their grievances with King George. It says, "We therefore, the representatives of the United States of America, in General Congress, assembled and appealing to the Supreme Judge of the world for the rectitude of our intentions." So again, it's an acknowledgement that they're bringing their grievances to England, yes, but this isn't their own demands. It's saying, we are given these rights by God, and we're asking you to, as the ruling power at the time, to enforce them. And these are all, of course, at the time, deeply influential and acknowledged by the leaders in our country. So our third subject, our third heading here, is kind of the intellectual architects of the modern society we see. And you've probably heard of John Locke. He was an English philosopher. So Locke argues that human beings possess natural rights. So if you ever heard the term natural law or natural rights, it's not, at least I used to think of it as just kind of nature, but it's understanding that it's God's divine nature or order. So if you hear that term natural law or natural rights, it's a little pessimistic sense here, attempt to remove God from the discussion. But so the natural order is God's order. And it's just you know, we can't be perfect, unfortunately. Locke argued that human beings possess natural rights to life, liberty, and property because they are created again by God. That's where our human dignity comes from. In John Locke's second treatise of government, he writes, "The workmanship of one omnipotent and indefinite wise maker." So because humans belong to God, Locke argued, no one has the right to rule others arbitrarily. So it's not your position, but it's to rule for an ordered society. Second is William Blackstone, who I mentioned earlier. That's a name I'm familiar with, but he's a English jurist, but commented on laws in you know, going to law school, you hear the Blackstone. Blackstone is actually used as a commentary for kind of interpretations or what was going on, and looked at as a really a founding jurisprudence, especially for our American system. So Blackstone writes in his Law of Nature is essentially dictated by God himself. So again, there's law of nature or natural law. He argues that the human law must conform to God's moral law. And Blackstone's writings were used as foundational legal textbooks in early America and strongly influenced in the development of our American law. A lot of what we have codified comes from English common law, and common law is really just cases that were tried in courts. And so while we, you know, have the benefit of coming from England and having all these codes or statutes, a lot of that comes from the cases and then Blackstone's own commentary on those. So Blackstone's work reflects a legal tradition rooted in a belief that justice ultimately comes from a moral order established by our Creator God. So number four, presidents and statesmen on religion and liberty. So George Washington, in his farewell address, says, "Of all the dispositions and habits which lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable supports." And I like this because, as I'll get to in a little bit, we talk a lot about rights, but not necessarily a duty. And so understanding that the political needs a moral is something that I think is a little bit lost, and our founding fathers understood. John Adams, as I mentioned previously in my last message, this is a wonderful quote, I think is just so sharp and on point in talking about our Constitution. He says, "Our Constitution was made for only a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other." Again, that for all the rights we have, and we can have all these laws and things, but those are attempts to establish the moral order. The moral order comes from God in the Bible. One interesting character I did in my research is a man named Alexis de Tocqueville. He's a French observer. He was a well-to-do aristocrat, managed to survive the French Revolution, but he also seemed to understand the plight of the workers and that imbalance between the ruling class and those that weren't. And so Tocqueville writes in his commentary in watching the French Revolution, says, "Religion must be regarded as the first of their political institutions." So he believes that religion is kind of helps, I don't know if quell is the right word, but temper the both on the common class, but also the duty on the ruling class to strive to the godly values that is necessary for a democratic government to form for the benefit of both sides. Of course, then we have Abraham Lincoln. During the Civil War, Lincoln spoke to the nation's crisis in his second inaugural address, and he said, "Both read the same Bible and both pray to the same God." I find this difficult, maybe, or vexing is the right word, as a historical quote, because it requires me to start from a place of mercy when encountering those I may disagree with. You know, I think we all want to be judge, jury, and executioner, or maybe that's just me, but I'm always thankful that God, you know, comes with grace and mercy when I fall short. And so it's just a reminder to start there with those that are, you know, in earnest, note to self, choose better words, in an earnest conversation of repentance. And that is just the grace, and then obviously an acknowledgement of God from Abraham Lincoln. So section 5 is the jurist. This is maybe the section I enjoyed, not most, but I truly enjoyed bridging the law and the Bible. They are, the Bible is a lawgiver, and that's what I do day to day and enjoy. So here's a couple quotes from jurists that I look up to and respect. So the jurist is the law and the moral foundation of rights. So Justice William O. Douglas, he was an associate justice on the Supreme Court in 1952. And he says, "We are a religious people whose institutions presuppose a supreme being." So again, an acknowledgement of God and then that implicit moral authority that comes in our democratic society. So Douglas was not advocating for a national church, but he was acknowledging the history and foundation of our the government structure that we have. Another Supreme Court justice is Antonin Scalia. He's got a couple opinions I like, but he's reflecting on the Declaration of Independence here in this quote. And he says, "The Declaration says that we are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights." And so he says, "Rights come from God, not from government. Otherwise, if the rights come from government, government can remove them. But if the rights come from our Creator, the government must respect them and they can't take them away." And lastly here, Justice Clarence Thomas. He's another justice, you know, conservative, obviously, but in his lecture at Notre Dame, Justice Thomas explained that the Declaration rests on the truth. He says that human beings are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, quoting the Declaration, that reflects the biblical teaching that human dignity is a rooted creation in God. And again, we see this back in Genesis 1:27, as I mentioned earlier. So because people, that's us, bear God's image and possess dignity, that we should all be treated underneath or equal before the law, the governments must respect that law that is given by God, not the government. And so I, you know, wanted to phrase this, why do I highlight these examples? And the book of Judges comes to mind, as if our leaders acknowledge God, they can lead us to a revival, to peace and prosperity. And that those leaders are grounded in faith. And I see that something today. I know how the book is written. I know where we end up and what must happen. But my hope is I live in a revival in Judges. I hope that it's not one of the other seven, you know, judges. It's like one good one, seven bad ones, one good one, seven bad ones. I'd like to live in a good judge period. So here, in number 6, what has Christianity contributed to Western freedom? And this is kind of my recap and summary here. So Christianity has thought and helped give Western civilization several crucial ideas. The human equality, that we are all grounded or made in the image of God. It limited government, that the rulers are accountable to us, but also the moral law or natural law, which is basically just an extension of God. Freedom of conscience. Faith cannot be coerced, that we should not shy away, and we should be proud of our rich Christian history. a rule of law, again, impartiality between rich and poor and ruler and common citizen. A moral responsibility, that the liberties that we enjoy also require a virtue and a duty to hold these ideals up. These ideas have shaped the institutions, that's the wrong word, documents of the Magna Carta, a constitutional government, and the protection of the individual rights. So what does that mean for us today? First, I'm abundantly grateful that we get to live in such a society built on biblical ideas. Again, many of the freedoms today don't get acknowledged as the foundations for those freedoms that we enjoy. We must not forget our roots of liberty. A society cannot remain free forever if it abandons the moral truth that created that freedom. Okay. And so if we believe that liberty requires virtue, we must cultivate virtue, and virtue demands adherence to the Creator's laws or his wisdom that provides us with the liberty that we've come to know and expect today. And so I hope you can see how the progress of these documents as societies were forming their governments. This is why the Magna Carta limited kings, the Declaration of Independence spoke of a creator, Washington spoke of religion and morality needing to be both present in government. And this is where our Western tradition of freedom grew in a soil nourished by the Bible. If we want to preserve the best of that tradition, we must remain connected to the source from which it grew. Happy Sabbath, brethren.